Well, good morning. It's good to see this number out. Occasionally, we like to do a lesson on someone from history, someone from either Old Testament or New Testament history, someone we can learn some lessons from, and that's what we're going to do this morning. I want us to consider this morning together the Preacher King, and the reason I called it the Preacher King, if you look over in at the first of the book of Ecclesiastes, he referred to himself as the preacher. He said, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And of course, we're talking about Solomon, perhaps, you know, one of the greatest kings of Israel. Things were pretty good under the reign of David, but he was still fighting a lot of battles. And in the 40-year period that Solomon reigned, Israel enjoyed relative peace, a lot of prosperity. And it was kind of, you know, if the Israelites years and generations later could go back to something, if it wasn't David, it would have been Solomon. Not only was Solomon prosperous, everybody in Israel was prosperous. It was a united kingdom. It was really the heyday of the people of Israel. And so we're going to talk about King Solomon. He was the son of David, but you know, there were a lot of fellows who were sons of David. If you go back and look at the list, I think I counted, 17. He had quite a few sons. He had the first six or seven in Hebron. And then when he got to Jerusalem, he married more. He married, of course, Bathsheba, and then more women, had some concubines. And so he had quite a few more sons after he got to Jerusalem. Now, we're not going to go through all of these. A couple of them are notable. Amnon was the oldest. Solomon was actually the oldest son of Bathsheba, the oldest son that survived. And so, you know, why Solomon? He certainly wasn't the oldest. You know, we often think of, in a dynasty, we think of the king dying and his oldest son taking over. That wasn't always the case, but it often worked that way. And yet Solomon appears to be down in the list somewhere. And, you know, you can't help but sort of wonder why. When it came time for Solomon to begin to reign, two of the brothers were already dead. You recall Absalom had a sister. These fellows all had different mothers, at least the first seven. Absalom had a sister, Tamar, and the oldest brother, Amnon, raped his half-sister, Tamar. For some reason, David did nothing about it, so Absalom took things into his own hands and had his brother Amnon, his half-brother Amnon, killed. Later, Absalom tried to take the kingdom away from his father David, and there was a battle that ensued, and Absalom was killed in that battle. So by the time David is getting old and is getting ready to turn the kingdom over to someone else, two of them are dead, but he still has several brothers that are older than he is. Why Solomon? Well, I think the scriptures give us some indication of that. God loved Solomon. Now, I don't know what all that means, but that's exactly what the scriptures tell us. You recall that David and Bathsheba had an affair. She became pregnant. David had her husband murdered so that he could marry her. It was a great sin in David's life. And of course, Nathan made him aware of that, of the seriousness of that, and he repented. But God said, even though you've repented, the baby that Bathsheba is about to have is going to die. And that baby, in fact, passed away. But we see over in 2 Samuel chapter 12, beginning in verse 24, then David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went into her and lay with her, and she gave birth to a son, and he named him Solomon. Now the Lord, all caps, L-O-R-D, Jehovah. Now Jehovah loved him and sent word through Nathan the prophet, and he named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. And if you look up Jedidiah, it simply means beloved of Jehovah. And so God loved this baby. But you know, even before he was born, God had appeared to David and told him over in 1 Chronicles chapter 22, beginning in verse 9, "Behold, a son will be born to you who shall be a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side, for his name shall be Solomon. And I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever." The reason David put Solomon on the throne when his time was through is because that's who God wanted on the throne. Now, you ask the question, why did Jehovah love this child? Why did Jehovah want Solomon to be the next king? We don't know. That's up to God. God is sovereign, but it was God's choice. It wasn't David's choice. Now, you recall that when David was older, I don't know about Chileab, Abigail's son. We're not told much about him, but Adonijah was certainly around. He knew he was older than Solomon, and when David got older, Adonijah took it upon himself to get with Joab and others and to have himself proclaimed as the king of Israel. Well, when Nathan and Bathsheba found out about it, they went to the aged David and appealed to him in order to rectify the situation. David immediately had Solomon put on the throne, had a crown put on his head, had him proclaimed as king, and that was serious politically for Adonijah. And of course, he and his supporters just sort of slinked off into the woodwork, and that was the end of that uprising on Adonijah's part. And so David proclaimed his son Solomon king even before his death. Now, after David died, there were ceremonies, and David offered Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings before the Lord. But God appeared to him on that occasion, and he said, "Ask what I shall give you." That was God talking to Solomon. "You ask me whatever you want, and I'll give it to you." Well, this is what Solomon asked for. In 2 Chronicles 1, 8 through 10, "You have dealt with my father David with great loving kindness and have made me king in his place. Now, O Lord God, your promise to my father David is fulfilled, for you have made me king over a people as numerous as the dust of the earth. Give me now wisdom and knowledge that I may go out and come in before this people, for who can rule this great people of yours?" Over in 1 Kings, he said, "I'm but a child. I don't even know how to come in before this great people. Please give me knowledge and wisdom so that I can rule your people the way that they need to be ruled." God appreciated where his heart was at. And God told him, "You could have asked for riches and wealth. You could have asked for honor for yourself. You could have asked for the life of those who oppose you, that are your enemies. You could have asked me for long life. You didn't ask for any of that. Instead, your heart's in the right place. You were humble enough to understand the gravity of ruling a people like this. And you're humble enough before me to come to me and ask me for the wisdom and knowledge it takes to do that." And so he told him in 2 Chronicles 1 verse 12, "Wisdom and knowledge have been granted to you, and I will give you riches and wealth and honor such as none of the kings who were before you has possessed, nor those who will come after you." And so God appreciates it. He gives him the wisdom and the knowledge that he asked for, but because he appreciated his attitude, he gave him the riches and honor and glory that went along with that. Well, we're going to, obviously, we're told a lot about the life of Solomon, and we only have a certain amount of time this morning. We're going to look at the life of Solomon as a real, from a high level, look at it as an overview. We're going to talk about his unsurpassed wisdom, his impressive wealth, and the honor that he received, the social and spiritual experiments that he embarked on, and his idol worship later in life. And then we'll see if there are some lessons that we can glean from the life of this great king. He really had wisdom like none other, and it was demonstrated in a lot of ways. It was demonstrated in his judgments, and probably the most famous case is over in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 28. Two prostitutes, each had a child. One of them rolled over on her son in the middle of the night and smothered him, and the other was sleeping, and so she swapped babies. She took the live one and put the dead baby in the other woman. Well, any mother here will tell you she knows her baby. And this woman wakes up in the morning and there's a dead baby in bed with her, and it's not hers, it's the other woman's baby. And so it comes before the court of Solomon, and they're both saying, "No, this live baby is mine." And the other one says, "No, this live baby is mine." And Solomon says, "Bring a sword. Just bring a sword in here and just cut him in half and give one half to one woman and the other half to the other woman." And one of the women said, "That's fine. If I can't have him, neither one of us should have him." And the other woman said, "No, don't hurt the child. Give him to the other woman." And Solomon said, "That's the mother. Give the baby to that mother." Now, it doesn't say what he did with the other woman. I'd be interested to know. But word of that got around, and people begin to fear Solomon, and I don't think that means they were terrified of him, but they had a reverence and respect for this man. This is a man with wisdom that doesn't just come to the average person. He had to get that wisdom from God. But it was a famous case, and word spread quickly. It was demonstrated in his public policy. You remember Teddy Roosevelt once said, walk softly and carry a big stick. And I've always thought that's probably a good philosophy for a country to follow. But you know, Solomon enjoyed a lot of, the people of Israel enjoyed relative peace and safety during the reign of Solomon. But we're told that he had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, 40,000 horse stalls. He built storage cities around Israel. He built cities for his chariots and horsemen. He built fortified cities. Did he need them? I don't know. I mean, apparently it doesn't look like he did, but it could be part of the peace and prosperity that God granted him was through some of the wise decisions about carrying a big stick. He certainly was the kind of king that you didn't want to cross lightly. And they certainly enjoyed prosperity. We're told that Solomon was somewhat of an arms dealer, if you want to look at it that way. He would import chariots and horses from Egypt, and he would resell them to the kings of the Hittites and the Aramaeans up north. Okay, so he was making profit off of buying and selling horses and chariots. But God gave him rest on every side. If God promised him rest, would he have given him rest without all the big army? Of course he would. Didn't need that. But it just showed some wisdom on his part. Everybody in Israel was prosperous. It wasn't just Solomon. We're told that, and I don't see it on this slide, but you know, silver was so common in Israel at the time, it was like the stones laying out on the ground. I mean, everybody had it good. Solomon appointed 150 officers to rule over the people. He had 12 deputies. I'll tell you, Solomon had a large entourage. There were a lot of people under his direct care, a lot of people he fed every day. And so he appointed these 12 deputies, and each one of these men had a month of the year assigned to him, and it was his job for that month to provide for all the needs of the king and his family and his household. And so we're told Judah lived in safety, every man under his own vine, his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. These people had it good, and they knew it. There were testimonials of his wisdom. We had our scripture reading this morning about the Queen of Sheba who came to test him with difficult questions. That's what she had in mind when she came to town. But it didn't take her long to find out that this man was for real. And all of a sudden she stopped just asking him trick questions and began to speak with him about all that was in her heart. She wanted sincere answers to sincere questions that she had about the meaning of life. And we're told in 1 Kings 10 and verse 3, Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king which he did not explain to her. When the Queen of Sheba perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of his waiters and their attire, his cupbearers and his stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. She was speechless. It just knocked the wind out of her. Then she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe in the reports until I came and my eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity the report which I heard. How blessed are those your servants who stand before you continually and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God who delighted in you to set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do right, justice and righteousness." Made a believer out of the Queen of Sheba. Seeing was believing, and all the reports and the rumors that she had heard back home didn't tell half the story. And then it was demonstrated in his words. In 1 Kings chapter 4, beginning in verse 29, "Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, Heman, Heman, Calcol, or Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was known in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. You know, we still have his Proverbs, Book of Ecclesiastes, the Song of Solomon, and I think at least one of the Psalms he wrote, and that's included in the Psalms that we have. But you can see it in his writings, the wisdom that he had been given by God. He was given impressive wealth by God. He had a palace that took 13 years to build. Every 3 years, a fleet of ships would show up that brought gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. Other kings were constantly bringing him every year gifts of silver and gold and garments and weapons and spices and horses and mules. Silver was as common as the stones out laying out on the street. He had houses and vineyards and gardens and parks and ponds and male and female singers and flocks and herds, silver and gold and the treasure of kings. He was greater than all the kings of the earth, and it was because God chose to bless him is the reason he had all that wealth. But Solomon took it upon himself to perform some experiments, social experiments. You know, sometimes we'll see a daredevil on TV and they'll put some at the bottom of the screen, "Don't try this at home." I suggest you can read Ecclesiastes, you can read the writings of Solomon, but don't try this at home. It's not advisable. And you can question maybe whether it was advisable for Solomon to do all the things that he did. But you know, he did those things as experiments, and he wrote the book of his Ecclesiastes as documentation of the experiments that he had run. And I'll tell you, we can save ourselves a lot of headaches by learning from the mistakes of others. Every generation doesn't have to go out and make the same mistakes and suffer all the same consequences. We can look back at people that made some bad decisions and have said since then, "Don't do what I did, it was a horrible thing to do." And that's exactly what Solomon has left for us. There's no need for us to repeat his mistakes and his failures. We can go back and learn from him. One thing he did was to set his mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under the sun. He said in Ecclesiastes 1:17-18, "I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly." It wasn't just that he was wise with the wisdom God gave him. He set out to learn everything he could learn and to gain all of the wisdom and knowledge that he could possibly get his hands on, to see if that's part of what life is all about. If that's the way we can find fulfillment in this life, is getting as highly educated as we can possibly get to become wise in the way of the world so that we can handle the situations of life and be successful. Is that what life's all about? And that's what he wanted to find. But he said, "I realize that this also is striving after wind." What's it worth, Solomon? It's striving after wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. You know what comes with increasing knowledge and increasing wisdom sometimes? Increasing responsibility. People find out you know some things and they say, "Well, we'll have you do more. You know, we'll have you responsible for the welfare of a lot more people, you know. And now see how well you sleep at night when you have the burden of the weight of all of this on your shoulders because of your wisdom and knowledge." And Solomon said it's a burden. It is striving after wind. That's not the answer to life. That's not the answer to happiness in this life, is seeking all the wisdom and knowledge that you can possibly get your hands on. He experimented with mind-altering drugs. And you know, the substance of the day was alcohol. But he intentionally experimented with it to see what the effects were and see whether he could maintain his wisdom and his composure and control as he took more and more levels of alcohol. In Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 3, "I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives." Can I broaden my horizons? Can I increase my creativity by taking drugs, by taking alcohol? You know, is this one of the keys to an enhanced human life as we live this life here? Solomon wanted to find out. And of course, he writes in great detail in Proverbs 23 about some of his findings. He said, "Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper." And he goes on to talk about doing things you didn't know you did, and waking up in the morning and not knowing where you've been, and people striking you in the face and it doesn't even hurt because you're numb. And then when you're sobered up, you can't wait to start in and start drinking again because you've become addicted to the stuff. He found out the evils that can come from alcohol consumption, but he experimented with that and found out. But he left that for us. We don't have to go experiment and find out for ourselves the evils of that. Material wealth and pleasure. Over in Ecclesiastes 2, those houses and vineyards I talked about a while ago, Solomon said, "I heap that on myself." It wasn't just that God blessed me. He put a lot of material resources at my disposal. He gave me a lot of political power. And as part of this experiment, I just decided to heap as much of this stuff on myself personally. We're not talking about national wealth. We're talking about Solomon wealth. And I got for myself houses and vineyards and gardens and parks and fruit trees and ponds and flocks and herds and silver and gold and provinces. Political power, material wealth like you wouldn't believe. You know what? We couldn't do the experiments as Solomon did if we tried. We don't have the resources. And he had it all at his fingertips. And he heaped all that on himself to see, you know, if material wealth will make a person happy, this level of materialism should make me ecstatic. I could just be the happiest man in the world. He said in verse 10, "All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor." He had male and female singers, a lot of concubines. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He didn't withhold anything from himself. He was going to find out if this is the key to the happiness. Surely to goodness this will show it to me, because I've got it all. I've got more than anybody's ever had, and maybe as much in relative terms as anybody's ever had since. He was infinitely wealthy. And yet he said, "Behold, it too was futility. I said, of laughter it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? It's vanity. It's worthless." And people can heap up and pile up for themselves as much material wealth as they can possibly get their fingers on. And when they lay their bed down, their head down on the pillow at night, they know in their heart of hearts they are miserable. This is not what life's all about, and I can never get enough. And when I get up tomorrow, I'm going to see if I can find some more of it, because I've got so much now I don't know what to do with, and it's not enough. And Solomon told it for. We don't have to go suffer all the pain and suffering of learning that for ourselves. And how many of us sacrifice our lives to get a penance of what Solomon had? And we think if we can just get that big screen TV or another nice new car, that's going to make me happy. I'm not happy now, but that'll do it. And Solomon said, that's foolishness. It's vanity. It's not going to work. Not going to happen. I've tried it to a level that nobody else could possibly achieve. And it's vanity. We have to talk about Solomon's wives if we're going to talk about Solomon. Like I said, he had 700 of them, along with 300 concubines. But over in 1 Kings chapter 3, we're told that Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now, if I understand the context, this was his first wife. And at this point in time, he had the one wife. And he did it partly for political expediency. It was in order to form an alliance with Pharaoh, and it could be that many of the other 700 were for the same reason. We don't know. But it's interesting that earlier in the days of Solomon, 1 Kings 3:3 describes his attitude toward God and his spiritual character. It said that Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. Now, I believe that his sacrifices and incense on the high places at this point were still to Jehovah God and not to idols. But he was doing it from the high places, and those were often used for the worship of idols, and so it's just one step in the wrong direction. But he was faithful to God. He was walking in the statues of the Lord like his father David had done before him. But he wasn't content with his Egyptian wife. Over in 1 Kings chapter 11, we're going to read the first 8 verses. King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, "You shall not associate with them, nor shall you associate; they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods." There were times when the people of Israel didn't listen to God, but here's the king of Israel not listening to God. Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not follow the Lord fully, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. This also he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. Some of these high places that Solomon built were there all the way down almost to the end of the history of Judah as a people, and Josiah had to finally tear them down and destroy them. He left a legacy for generations after himself that was not good, and it was because of the evil influence of the women that he chose to marry. Well, of course, God was angry about that. Solomon had ignored his warnings. He had gone out and married these women and allowed them to drag him away from faithfulness to God, and there were punishments associated with that. God said in 1 Kings 11:11, "I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant." I'm going to take the kingdom away from you. We're also told that God raised up some adversaries. He had had peace all of his reign, but now he was given trouble by Hadad the Edomite and Rezon, the leader of a marauding band that was going around making raids, robbing people and doing damage in cities in Israel. But in deference to David, in deference to the faithfulness of his father David, God postponed the punishment on him. He said, "I'm going to tear the kingdom away from you, but I'm going to take it from your son. I'm not going to remove the kingdom in your day." And then in order to fulfill messianic prophecy, he didn't take all of the kingdom away from David's family. He had told David, "There's going to be one that's going to arise from your seed that's going to sit on your throne forever." That's what he promised David. And that was certainly true in Jesus through the tribe of Judah, through the family of David. And in the southern kingdom of Judah, every man who served on that throne down there in Judah were of the family of David. Well, we've talked about Solomon's unsurpassed wisdom and his impressive wealth and his social experiments and his idol worship that came about because of his association with his wives. I think there's some lessons we can learn. Matter of fact, there are a lot of lessons. I started jotting down notes and I had to pare the list down. You know, we could be here past lunchtime just talking about all the lessons that we could get from Solomon's life. But you know, we should learn from his wisdom. And you know, we can read and study through the Proverbs and all the advice that he gave to his son and all the things that he told us about the nature of man and the nature of life and what constitutes wise decisions in our lives and what are foolhardy for us. We can learn that great learning as an ultimate objective is not the key to happiness. That's what he said in the first of Ecclesiastes. We can learn that the pursuit of wealth is actually destructive. The love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and people have destroyed themselves because of the love of money. Pleasure, even wholesome enjoyment, is not the basis of a fulfilled life. It's just not. And if we're looking every day for the next better entertainment than we enjoyed yesterday so we can add some color to our lives, we're missing the point of what our life's all about. And we'll never achieve what Solomon did, and yet he said it's all vanity. We should learn from that. We need to learn that faithful service is a lifelong pursuit, and it should have been in Solomon's case, and it wasn't. And frankly, he turned his back on Jehovah God. He may have been offering sacrifices to God at the same time that he was offering sacrifices to Molech. But he turned his back on Jehovah God. The Hebrew writer wrote in Hebrews 12:1-3, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." It's a lifetime race. It's an endurance race. It's not a sprint. And Jesus said over Revelation 2:10-11, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death." We need to be faithful to death. That's our charge as disciples of Jesus. This is not a sprint. We're in it for the long haul. And we can't allow things in this life or people in this life to drag us down or to divert us in the wrong direction. We've got to keep our eye on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, so that we can run that race faithfully until the end of our life. And then Christ has to come first. And that should influence our choices and relationships. But you know, no matter what happens, no matter who we're associated with, no matter who we're related to, you can't pick your mom and dad, but no matter who we're around, no matter who we're related to, Christ has to come first. Let me give you one viewpoint that I think is an okay way to word it, but I'm going to give you a better one. I need to choose a mate who will be a good influence on me. That's noble. That's fine. But I think that's still the wrong focus. That's, you know, when I get married, my focus is going to be making my mate happy. So I better choose somebody that when I make them happy, God's going to be happy too. Now, I know that's not what they really mean, but that's sort of underlying that, you know. It's better to say that I'm going to resolve to put Christ first in my life. That's what I resolve to do. And then I'm going to go find a mate that's resolved to put Christ first in their life. Now the problem's gone, isn't it? I live my life not to please my mate who in turn agrees with Christ. I'm here to please Christ, and my mate's perfectly supportive of that. And my wife is here to support Christ and to be devoted to Christ 100%, and I'm supportive of her in that. That's what Christ is looking for. If you put father, mother, brother, sister, husband, and wife, anybody ahead of me, you're not fit to be my disciple. We need to go out and find people that feel the same way. And the problem will go away, right? We need to be looking for mates that are wholly devoted to the Lord. And then finally, ultimately, my decisions determine who I am. You know, we've had a lot of Bible classes, and we often talk about knowledge and how important that is, but that's getting the facts and stuffing the facts in there, you know. And then wisdom is, you know, understanding how to apply those facts in the right way. And all that's well and good. But, you know, we need to add step 3 on there. And it's the step that Solomon missed. Solomon had all the knowledge and wisdom you could possibly imagine. But at some point, I've got to resolve to serve Christ and make the right decisions that I know are right. And I can have all the knowledge and wisdom in the world, and if I'm not going to apply it in my life, it's worthless. It was worthless in Solomon's later years. It's, you know, we got to have the knowledge. The truth will set us free. We need to pray for wisdom, and we need to exercise our senses to discern between good and evil, as it says in Hebrews 5:14. We need to do that. Knowledge and wisdom are so important. But I have got to submit my will to the will of Christ and the will of God. And if I'm not willing to do that, the fact that I wander off and say, well, I know better, but I'm going to do what I want anyway, is worthless. We need the knowledge and the wisdom and the resolve, the commitment to say, I'm going to submit my will to His will. And the first time I feel like doing something and it violates the will of God, I'm going to go with His will instead of mine in all things. I'm going to do my best to mold my will around His will to where His will feels natural for me. Have to make the commitment to go along with the knowledge and the wisdom. Are you ready for a lifelong commitment this morning? Solomon said at the conclusion of Ecclesiastes, he does all these experiments, he heaps all this stuff on himself, and that doesn't work, and he tries something else, he says, that's not the answer to life, and he tries something else, he says, that's vanity of vanities, what's it all about? It's worthless. And at the conclusion he says, in chapter 12 and verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. This is the whole of man. This is what we're all about. Duty is italicized. The translators threw it in there. It's the whole of man to fear God and keep His commandments. That's what we're here for. And it's not just subservient slavery. Solomon's saying that's the answer to fulfillment in life. That's the answer to joy and rejoicing in this life. Is to realize who God is and where I am in relation to Him and my dependency on Him and my admiration and love for Him for what He's done for me. And I submit my will to His will. My whole life becomes being about fearing Him, honoring Him, reverencing Him, and keeping His commandments, because that's what I'm here for. That's the whole of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Are you willing to submit your will to the will of God? That's the answer to true fulfillment in this life. And anybody that tells you anything different than that either doesn't know or they're lying to you. You want to live a fulfilled life? You want to have life with your Creator after this life is over? You got to come to Him. You got to come to Him humbly and submit your will to His will. You've got to repent of all those old past sins you've committed. Not look back on them with longing and wish I could have those days again. Put those things behind you. Repent of those things. Confess Him as Lord of your life and be buried in the waters of baptism. For the remission of your sins, to become a child of God, to put on a relationship with Christ, to become a disciple of His. And you will embark on a life, you'll be a new creature, you'll embark on a life that is truly the basis for true fulfillment and rejoicing and joy in this life and the life to come. If you're subject to the invitation this morning, come forward and make that known while we stand and sing.